And good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I am your host, Paul Rowland. And with incredibly impeccable timing, my co-host Jacqueline Keeler walked in as the song by Buffy St. Marie Power Sing, our own song, was just winding down. So we have Jacqueline in the studio, and we are waiting for our guest, Deborah Maytubi Denton, the founder of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA, who will be calling in, we assume, shortly. Perhaps she's even listening right now. So if you are, please call in. And Deborah, you probably heard, we've talked about this issue in the past on the show, and it was also featured on our program, Voices from the Edge. We had five Native women in talking about this issue last Thursday because, Deborah Denton worked with the City of Portland to get May 5th declared Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Awareness Day. With that long introduction, good morning, Jacqueline.
Good morning.
So, as I said, we're waiting. I was actually, if you hadn't showed up right on time, I would have started reading from this article you just have out on in High Country News. Just came out, I believe, yesterday. No crime scene, the search for Olivia Lone Bear. Native families grapple with scant support to locate their missing loved ones. I don't know, maybe you'd like to perhaps start out by reading a paragraph or two or not.
Sure. Yes, I can do that. I was actually in late January or February, I was in North Dakota, and I got to be with the family, the Lone Bear family. They live on the Fort Berthold Reservation, which is one of the largest reservations. It's over 1 million acres. And their loved one went missing on October 24th, and she's been missing for over 6 months. And Olivia Lone Bear is the mother of four living children, one deceased. And she's in her early 30s. She and they've never seen her since, and there is no body. And one of the things let me just go ahead and read this a little bit and open it up. I called it No Crime Scene, the search for Olivia Lone Bear. Native families grapple with scant support to locate their missing loved ones. 13 minutes into Taylor Sheridan's feature film Wind River, the body of a young Native woman from the Wind River Reservation, Wyoming, is discovered by the protagonist, a white hunter who works for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. That spurs a multi-agency investigation, and within days, officers from the Federal Bureau of Investigation and local and tribal law enforcement face off in a bloody Tarantino-style shootout with the bad guys, oil workers living in the company-owned temporary housing known as man camps. According to Sheridan, the family is inspired by true events and the thousands of actual stories just like it, involving the sexual assault of Native American women on reservations across the country. Yet Native families seldom get such dramatic closure or swift justice. Rarely do local or federal law enforcement officers respond so quickly or take bullets in defense of tribal members. Had Sheridan really wanted to be true to life, he would have ended his film with the family never finding the body of their loved one, much less tracking down the culprit. On October 24, 2017, a real Native American woman, a 33-year-old mother of four named Olivia Lone Bear, disappeared from the Fort Berthold Reservation in North Dakota. Her family has been frantically searching for her ever since. Like so many others, though, they've run up against uncooperative law enforcement agencies, which are themselves stymied by jurisdictional complications and a lack of resources. Tribal police told us they couldn't investigate Olivia's disappearance because there was no crime scene, her cousin Matthew Lone Bear told me in February, shortly after the Bureau of Indian Affairs took over the investigation from the three affiliated tribes police. And this is the first two
words. So while we're waiting for Deborah, why is this issue, why do you feel so strongly about this issue?
Well, I think, I first really became aware of it when they were fighting to pass VAWA, the Violence Against Women's Act, in 2013, which was held up for 2 years by Republicans who did not want to give expanded powers of jurisdiction to Native American tribes over non-Indians. And basically, it's this gap in jurisdiction because of the history of jurisdiction of tribes in the early reservation years on a Lakota reservation, a tribal member was let off. His name was Crow Dog, And so this result was he was his murder of another tribal member was basically adjudicated within traditional ideas of how to do this. And this became this big deal back east. All the newspapers made this big deal about it, that Indians were letting him off and all this stuff. So it created this thing called Ex Parte Crow Dog, which basically led to the limitation of jurisdiction of Native tribes, which became the Major Crimes Act, which there are five major crimes which tribes cannot have jurisdiction over. And one of them is murder, right? And so it goes to the FBI. It becomes a federal issue. And in most of these cases, particularly with Native women, what the Department of Justice found in a 2010 report was that that over 70% of these cases, the FBI declines to investigate, right?
And why do you think that is?
I don't know. You know, it's just typical. Yeah. And then and on top of that, there are other jurisdictional issues. I mean, there's a whole matrix of how to determine who has jurisdiction. So tribes also do not have jurisdiction over non-natives, people who are not enrolled in a federally recognized tribe. Right. So that means that people living on the reservation or coming to the reservation, the tribal police do not have jurisdiction over them. Who are not enrolled in a tribe, right? And so this leaves a huge gap. If someone is married, a non-native is married into the tribe, you know, and they were to beat or even murder their spouse, the tribal police would not have jurisdiction over that person, right? Or a random person coming onto the reservation. And so when you have the Bakken and you have all these man camps, where you have particularly at the height of the boom and the oil price of oil is going up again. With President Trump's threats with Iran, which is raising the price of oil, which increases the chances that they're going to be doing more drilling, you have all these people who the tribe does not have jurisdiction over. And the reservation is over 1 million acres. And when I was working on a documentary on that reservation in 2013, what I talked to a lot of tribal members, and it was really difficult to actually get to these man camps, and they weren't on any maps. So you didn't even know where they were located. They just kind of sprang up in the out in the prairie, and also the traffic was really bad because of all the water trucks. Travelers were being killed just going to the grocery store, and these are just like, you know, not really well maintained roads, right? With these massive traffic jams, and then also the jurisdictional issues. The Fort Berthold Reservation straddles six different counties, which means six different sheriffs have jurisdiction. Great. So I hear Deborah's here. So, but it's a big jurisdictional issue, and people know that they can go on the reservation and murder and rape and get away with it.
And of course, there's I guess the question I was getting at with the why the FBI doesn't investigate. I guess my speculation would be that, you know, they've been often a repressive force in Indian country, so I could imagine they wouldn't mind that there's a lot of chaos and violence going on necessarily in Indian country, that so they would perhaps almost favor that. I don't know.
It's just, you know, the resources aren't there. I mean, even talking to folks about the tribal police, you know, there's huge turnover in the force. There's no database, that we don't know the actual numbers, and there's no sharing of data. And often it's not required that they identify Native women. And so we don't even, it's, the numbers we have are not good, not solid numbers. And there's no interagency, there's little interagency, there's no protocol to share this and to work together. And so it's, yeah, anyway. So Deborah, let's get Deborah. Yeah.
Well, since we have Deborah Maytubi Denton on the line, good morning.
Good morning.
So you, obviously, this is something you work on all the time. You founded Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA. Maybe just a little bit, tell us about yourself and how you got involved in this.
Oh, I actually ran a cellular market in Southern Oregon. And then when I lost my job due to Verizon coming in and buying us out, I decided to go back to school. And when I went back to school, I went to Da Nang College, Navajo Nation College, because it, you know, I just had a low credit hour, and my in-laws were all down there. And so we began on that journey, and gosh, we were about maybe 7-8 months in, and we started losing our friends. And this all took place in Gallup, New Mexico. And two of my friends were murdered there. And I saw, well, when the first friend got murdered, I saw an absence of emotion in our other friends. And what I had gained one by one, I gained the knowledge that that they were not reacting anymore because they were used to it. And that's what broke my heart. And that's when I started working with the missing. And then came back to Portland about 6 years later and started seeing that it was in the Northwest here too. And just one state by one state, it I saw it was where reservation, that's where it was. And so I started Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA. And we're like 2.5 years into that now.
Great, thank you. And can you explain a little bit about your work with the City of Portland and the events that happened last week?
We were at an informational panel at PCC, and Laura John came forward afterwards and asked us if we'd be interested in helping, you know, if the mayor would sign this proclamation, we'd be interested in helping. And with great joy, we said yes, we'll do anything. Awesome. Yeah.
And maybe you could describe some of the events that happened last week. So,
We have like about 4 different informational panels going. Last Wednesday night, we had a dinner and then more speakers, and the mayor came out and spoke about that, you know, his reasons for doing that. And then Saturday, there was a meeting on Sunday too, but it all culminated into one information jammed week here in Portland. And we have seen a huge surge of people calling, people writing in several different ways in the last few days here. It's very wonderful, the people that are coming forward out of that whole week.
So have you been, as part of your work, have you been able to start compiling your own independent database? Talk a little bit about, are you involving communities directly in this effort?
Well, this is the thing that we started out trying to compile a database too. And we've actually got several studies going right now, you know, but they're not data on how many there are and things like that. We have been so busy with the families that the database fell to the back, you know, and because the families, we have to be there for them, the women first, and that we just didn't have the numbers within our organization to get somebody right on that. But there is a database that started, although that database is missing a lot of women because they just went off of data that was on existing, that was already existing in the system right now. And we know that those are wrong beyond anything. We know that the data that is there is definitely not showing the numbers that we have.
And could you you had a family of one of the missing murderers when we come out and speak at one. I was at the old church event on last Wednesday night. Could you describe sort of what they're going through and the challenges they face in trying to find their loved one? Because also, like the Lone Bears, they still haven't found her, right?
Yeah, and it's the same thing, Jacqueline. It's the same exact thing. If there is one difference Now, the family of Ashley Loring is the one that was with us at the Wednesday night event. And they actually saw a difference when the FBI took over their case. But it took them almost a year to even turn their eyes towards it. So, but the what we hear the most is the heartbreaking thing, is that they're embarrassed enforcement, and that there is virtually no communication at all. I've worked with one family for over 5 years, and not one time in that whole 5 years has the FBI stepped up and called them. Christy has to call the FBI, and then depending upon what agent she gets, that's they're all a different story, you know, from each different agent. But they're abandoned, and whatever's going on with the tribal police departments right now, and that's investigating, is absolutely horrendous. And we had this is so hard to talk about when we talk about these families, but we had since MMIW USA has been in effect, I've seen two instances where Yakima Tribal Police have waited more than a year after the body's been identified to tell the family. And that is, to me, just about the worst treatment that I've seen yet.
And you were saying the family, we were talking earlier, the family actually was doing searches, and the police never bothered to tell them while they were doing these searches across the reservation for an entire year.
You mean the family doing the searches?
Yeah.
Yeah, the families, that's what has to happen, you know, because there essentially is none, no searches. And the only time that I have seen a full-scale search is when, and it took them a while, was on Ashland Mike on the Navajo Reservation. And she was a little girl that was brutally murdered down there, and also another bad point towards law enforcement is like, we have no Amber Alerts on federal reservations. So that, you know, I often think back on Ashland and wonder what difference, you know, that could have made, because she was pretty close, you know. Not good.
Let me just reintroduce you. You just heard Deborah Maytubi Denton, founder of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA. And I'm Paul Rowan. I also have my co-host Jacqueline Keeler in the studio this morning. And it's time to invite your calls to the conversation at 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. You know, Deborah, you just mentioned the Yakimas. I just happened to come across a post you did on Facebook mentioning a really large number. I can't remember if it was 20 murdered and 21 missing or something like that, just on the Yakima Nation. Could you talk a little bit about that? Does that reflect? First, just talk specifically about the Yakimas and if that reflects, you know, what's going on in Indian country in general.
It does reflect what's going on in Indian country, and it also is one of the worst situations that we've seen. And per capita, Yakima is a lot worse than some of them. I mean, and I'm talking like worse than Pine Ridge or the Sioux reservations in the Dakotas. But Yakima, that the numbers are fluctuating all the time because, honest to goodness, there for a while we had a missing woman or a body every other week.
Wow.
And it's a very violent situation up there, and it's like when I had elders from over there come and warn me about some things that have happened, you know, with people that have tried to help. So they wanted me to have a full, you know, pretty much the full scope of what's going on up there. But at last count, there was 32 missing and about 28 murdered. And that's just simply since the 1990s. And if you do a Google search on Yakima and murder, you will find that they have been trying for years, since the 90s, to get something done up there. There's been statements made by the FBI repeatedly that there's no serial killer up there, because at one point, that's what they had thought. But
now, why would the FBI... Do they give a reason for thinking that?
No. That's the thing that's really heartbreaking about this, too, is even if you write or ask all the right questions, they usually don't say anything, you know. And that was simply the statement that was put out, was that there was no serial killer. And there's been... private parties that had a history in law enforcement, they have looked at that repeatedly. And one woman came out here, and she was told by tribal police, and that was in the 2000s, that that was probably about 10 years ago. But and when you ask them questions regarding why they waited so long to tell the families of, they do not answer. You know, they don't. And I'm hoping the new bill in Washington is going to make a difference in that, because part of the bill talks about. Like there having to be a database created up there, and then there has to be accountability for each of these women if there's no action on the case, there has to be accountability. Like, okay, well, what did happen then? And those kind of things. And I really hope that act will make a difference in going on what's going on for them, because what they've got used to there, it's the same situation as I saw with my Navajo friends down in the Southwest. It's like they're used to this, you know, and my God, no one should have to be used to murder. That's pretty hard to take.
Yeah, I'd say the same thing with Olivia Lombert's family. The reason I titled my article No Crime Scene is because when they tried to go to the tribal police to report her as missing, they were told by the MHA, the Mandan Hidatsa Rekra police, that that there was no crime scene, so because she just disappeared. And she was last heard of by this, I go into her whole... this white man who owns a trucking company there, works in the oil fields, you know, and he claims he was the last person to see her, and she was last seen in his truck, and she left without her wallet, without her debit card, without her phone, without even a jacket. And so the police were like, well, there's no crime scene, so you can't report her as missing, even. And I talked to other law enforcement, and they told me that that's not a thing. Like, that you can report someone missing. You know, there's no need for a crime scene to exist. And they were also told that they had no protocol for missing people. And this later the family did some investigating online, and they found the BIA tribal manual that has the whole protocol for dealing with missing people. And so all of this, they were basically given the runaround by the police, and they lost a lot of time that way. They had to set up their own search headquarters. They maintain it. They've had very little help from the tribal police in this matter. And the tribal police were actually telling when they would get help, other searchers coming in, even other law enforcement from other parts of from the Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota area, they would turn them away and say, "We don't need your help. They don't need your help." And they actually refused to, they claimed they didn't have a boat to do the searching on the water. Lake Sakakawea is a man-made lake that flooded a great deal of the reservation. With the dam, building of the dam in the 50s. And so they have this massive lake in the middle of the reservation. And last I talked to Matthew, her cousin, who's running the search, he said that only 10% of the lake had been searched. The only way they got the tribal police to respond was they drove by the police department, and all the boats that the police department owns were in the parking lot. And they took a photo of that, put that on Facebook, and said, you know, basically called them out online. They don't have, they had boats.
So, go ahead, Deborah.
Oh, it's that, that's just in a little bit different story for each reservation. You know, that's essentially it. They just don't act, and they don't think they have to justify it either. And that is, and was the most unbelievable thing to me, is how they just ignore and tell a little story, you know, but no explanation at all why they're not moving forward with things. There's just...
Well, it seems like, Jacqueline, you said earlier a lack of resources. I mean, I hate to say this, but it sounds like something else is going on other than lack of resources.
Yeah, that's something I want to investigate more, is what is, I mean, this isn't the, Ashley Heavy Runner Loring's family, and they are from Browning, Montana on the Blackfeet Reservation. And it was the same thing with their tribal police as well. Very little help, and from the local sheriff. They basically got the FBI involved, and that's been really helpful to them. With the Lone Bear family at Fort Berthold in North Dakota, they now, the BIA, the regional BIA tribal police, are in charge leading the investigation, and they're much happier with their work. They've been very much more cooperative. They've been keeping the family in the loop. It's strange. It does seem like it's the local tribal police that are not a lot of help. And as you heard in the Yakima Nation as well, you know, I think that's something that I'm going to definitely look at more. I want to publish a few more articles, and this also happens off the reservation as well. I noted in my article that you know, Native women have I think 10 times the rate of murder in some counties in the United States. 10 times. And these are Department of Justice numbers. And even in suburbia, they find that Native women have 3 times the rate of violence done to them. And so it's when I was touring for my book in Utah, I talked to a lot of there's this amazing Navajo people there who are really trying to change things. My friend Cassandra Begay, who really, she's the one that Secretary Zinke pointed his finger at her and was like, "Oh, you be good," because she kept asking him, "When are you going to talk to the tribes?" when he was visiting Bears Ears before he reduced it. And he turned to her and shook his finger in her face saying, "You be good." When I talked to her and I was there in October, she was devastated because her aunt had just been beaten to death by white men, just camping. She was out camping with her boyfriend at a campground, and these white guys came by and they just attacked them and beat them and beat her aunt to death. And then another friend of mine who was running for state legislature, another Navajo gal, was running for state legislature in Utah, and she, her mother had been beaten to death in Texas, dragged behind a truck by a white man. And these are just random acts of violence. And then I was, my book, I was doing a panel, and the moderator, Moroni Benale, who's a Stanford graduate, he's a Two-Spirit Navajo man. He actually ran for tribal president. There's a documentary coming out about him called Mr. Navajo. And he was supposed to moderate the panel, and he got beaten up the night before, really badly for being gay, right? And he tried to moderate the panel anyway, and it was horrible. He had gotten a concussion, and these are our most talented, vibrant Native leaders of the next generation, and they're being scarred by the violence of white men. And this is not on the reservation. This is just living their lives, and it's, you know, we really need to talk about white violence, terrorism against, and this is an ongoing thing. And you know, it's when you are part of the Native community, you hear this all the time. And yet most Americans are completely when people were reading my article, and I would say there's been a lot of really good reporting been done on this and great work by folks like Deborah. But still people read my article and this is the first time they've ever heard it. You know, and I'm a little surprised by that, because definitely the hashtag MMIW, which started in Canada, has really been very prominent and successful. But there's still so much work to do to make people aware and to change this.
And again, you're listening to Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Rowland. Once a month, every second Wednesday, co-host Jacqueline Keeler, who you just heard, is in the studio with me on the line. We have Deborah Maitoubi Denton, founder of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA. If you want to call in and talk to them, the number is 503-231-8187. And, you know, I know it. I'm also not up on this issue. I'm also one who is surprised by the numbers, although when I think about it, obviously it's not really surprising given the deep colonial context. I guess I just feel maybe it's a little too easy to ask a question like this, but it seems like there's a, you know, the historical political background seems all too evident that, you know, this sort of violence in particular against women, but in general, has all been used as a, you know, an actual overt political tool. I'm not saying that's what's going on here, but obviously the racism is obvious in what you're talking about, Jacqueline, and what you're talking about, Deborah. I guess what I want to ask is I guess first that, you know, the political nature of these crimes, but also, I mean, to talk more generally about reasons, if you know, there's patterns that are being discerned, and specifically, you know, in the Yakima case, you know, the idea that there's no supposedly no serial killer, but I mean, has there even been an attempt to sort of examine each individual case, discover patterns? You know, they discovered the Golden State Killer recently. Is there talk about a little bit about, you know, the broader picture here, Deborah?
Well, the same pattern that emerges is, and we've been saying it, is that there's a murder, and or a missing woman, and there's a report, and then there's no action. But there. It's a variety of different things and a variety of different ways. And it's just a little bit of everything. So there's no clear thing to point at, except a lot of this is related to domestic violence. So and then, you know, families get scared. A lot of these people live in little communities, they live in little communities, and there is no law enforcement in that town, and so they essentially get left, you know, high and dry. But
so you're talking, a lot of the problem is just the isolation is a big part of the problem.
Yeah, and it's like, and usually there's no, like I say, there's no law enforcement in that particular little town. And the other thing is that when they see law enforcement not taking action on anything, then it becomes even more afraid, you know, because they have nothing to protect them there. And, you know, they could be the next MMIW. It's just, it's this vicious circle. And like Jacqueline said earlier, you know, when there's an absence of law enforcement and things, people know that there's not going to be any repercussions for what they do, you know, and so they do it over and over and over. It's the same story.
Yeah, there's also the issue of trafficking.
Yeah.
You know, especially, you know, I think that you guys mentioned that night at one of the MIW events was about the issue of being near I-5, and which is a major trafficking route between, you know, Canada to Mexico and a major airport. And so I don't know if you want to go into this, but Deborah does amazing work with individuals who are facing trying to find lost relatives and also, you know, recovering from such experiences. And do you want to talk a little bit about that?
No, what was that question again?
Some of the work you do with the families and folks recovering from trafficking.
Yes. And like we actually were coming up on the busy season two for trafficking. And not only is Portland on the I-5 corridor, we've also got an international airport and a port, you know, and sometimes they get shipped clean across the waters, you know, and yes, I'm sorry, I've got someone knocking at my door.
Well, if you need to take care of that, go ahead. We can carry on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I got him. Thank you, though. Yes, that's the thing, and we've seen, and this is the horrible thing to me that I've discovered is that even if it's a child who's been trafficked over state lines, law enforcement totally dropped the ball on it. And we have, last summer we had multiple kids. And one of the situations we saw was there was, somebody had befriended a young woman from South Dakota online. And the woman came up from Oklahoma and got her and took her back down there. And over a few days, they started trusting her more. Like, so they'd leave their phone around, you know, laying around, stuff like that. She started sending her mother clues to where she was at. And we got it down to the absolute address that this young woman was at. And South Dakota police did not call Oklahoma police and get that little girl picked up. And what ended up we had to do was the little girl was very my tribe's territory, to Chickasaw territory. So I called our law enforcement. They in turn called the city law enforcement, and together they went out and had that little girl in 20 minutes. And then South Dakota police, it was Pierre, South Dakota, they literally freaked out on me, you know, of who are you and what do you think you're trying to do, and you're interrupting the job that we're doing. You know, I just laid it out for them and told them, you know, you are not doing your job is the thing. And so I stepped in to finish it.
And that's what they don't want to hear, obviously.
And yes, they don't. And the thing is, I went through, I mean, there were multiple law enforcement officers called me from Pierre, you know, questioning me, running my data. Like, do you have something to do with this little girl being missing?
Oh my God!
But oh yeah,
jeez.
It was unbelievable. And then finally, I got to the police chief, and he called me, and then he's like, okay, you're legit. You know, thank you for moving on that. And I said, your officers aren't doing a good job.
God, it's the level of incompetence is, and you know, it makes you wonder if, I don't know, if they're involved. Do you know what I mean? It's completely bizarre. And you actually had another. Do you want to talk a little bit about the work that the mayor of Portland is doing on this issue?
Well, you know, other than awareness, because they're doing a great job at letting people know what this is, letting them know the statistics, and just how, you know, how these women come up missing. I mean, they've done a great, 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 great job of making their employees aware, and it's not over yet. And then one of the things that we are going to do that we have talked about is like having a set protocol to follow when somebody comes missing in this city, and that being men or women, you know, because we've got a lot of men that's being killed too, at not the rate that the women are, but still, you know. And I think that just like when Portland stepped up and became the first city in the nation to adopt MMIW Awareness Day on May 5th, I think Portland's going to be the city that sets the next standard for what to do. And there's an incredible, Laura John is like doing an incredible job. We're starting to gear up for that, you know, because what you just saw last week was simply the first phase. This thing's going to be ongoing. And, you know, we totally do expect for other cities to follow us, especially with the Washington-Oregon the Washington-Oregon competition that we've saw. It's been pretty sweet to see them compete back and forth, but it's too bad that it took that. You know, it should have just been done, you know, out of regard for, you know, humankind, of human tenderness, human caring. But we don't take it any way we get it. You know, we want these people saved. And during the weeks of it was really interesting. During it was like April 30th that the mayor announced this reclamation, and we went before him. But at that particular time, we had a missing woman here in Portland, and also we had one 2 weeks prior. So it was like they did, honest to goodness, like, start to follow that same pattern where the family was trying to report their daughter missing up here, and the police had contact with Val like 2 weeks prior, and she had been in the Multnomah County Jail. And so they were like, they wouldn't take a missing report or even to check Val's well-being. They wouldn't do it because they said, we know she's all right. We had contact with her. Her absence is self-inflicted. And so anyway, I told the mayor that day, and by the end of the day, Val had been picked up and she was in a safe house. So, I mean, he did act on it. Somebody from his office, something happened, because they went right down back down to where they had police contact with her before, and she was there. So, and she was just saying that certain things, she was able to get out calls to her family, but there was something wrong with, they didn't like the way she sounded. They didn't, she was saying things that were not like her, you know, and that's why they wanted the welfare check in the first place. But yeah, so she was taken care of, and I have the utmost confidence that we will continue forward and be able to do more in our city, thanks to the mayor taking the first step.
And I'm sure your organization could use support. Is there a way people can? I noticed you have a Facebook site, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA. Is there ways people other than the Facebook site can get in touch and maybe support your work?
There's not a link on our website. We just like actually changed the URL again yesterday, but there's PayPal. We can take donations, and it's mmiwusa@gmail.com. So they can donate through there. And what we're planning on doing right now is very dear to my heart. There was a mother that showed up Wednesday night, and her daughter had went missing in LeGrand, and they had found her later in the Columbia. And she'd never had a service or a burial stone. And so we're going to be setting up a fundraiser here for her in order to get her taken care of, because she's taking care of her daughter's three children too. So we want to just help her do that. So next week we're organizing, then we'll be announcing when we'll do that fundraiser. And what we're going to do is an auction type of a situation. So if you have items you'd like to donate, just get to us on that Facebook site, and we'll arrange pickup. We've already got donations within, I would say, 2 minutes. Within 2 minutes of deciding to do this, we actually started getting donations at the powwow.
Great. And you also have t-shirts for sale, don't you?
Yes, we do. And that's like pinned to the top of the page on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA. And I believe that you can actually also type in MMIW USA into the search.
On Facebook.
There's a little search bar up there, yeah.
And I would ordinarily say that I would have all this information on my page for this program, Wednesday Talk Radio. Unfortunately, we had a hack attack a week or more ago, 10 days ago, I think, that's still influencing, and I wasn't able to do a program page for today's show. I'm not sure when I will, but when I am able, I will redo a page for this program and have all this information. We've got about 6 minutes left in the show. I want to refer once again to this article my co-host Jacqueline Keeler in the studio here just has out in High Country News, No Crime Scene, The Search for Olivia Lone Bear, extensive treatment of this issue. You want to just talk a little bit more about?
I think that, you know, I go into a lot of the data that's out there, and also just the legal fixes. There are a number of laws that are being proposed. Senator Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota has a law that she's proposing called, it's called Savannah's Act, which is named in honor of a young Native woman from Fargo who actually was murdered, Savannah Graywind, and she was murdered by her neighbor and who actually cut her baby out of her and then stole the baby, and they found her body wrapped in plastic in the river, and it was really tragic, and so they and once again the family had to run the searches. I mean, no help, very little help, you know, and it's you know, and the law is supposed to help, you know, get law enforcement to coordinate more with each other, to create a database, all of these things. And then, of course, VAWA is up for reauthorization, and they want to expand some of the powers in there as well. Very few tribes, not all tribes, have qualified yet for the expanded powers under the 2013 VAWA Act, which includes Violence Against Women Act, yeah. So the expanded powers gives the ones from 2013, which were passed in 2015, allow tribes to prosecute non-Indians who have a very definite relationship to a tribal member and have committed domestic violence. But they do not include violence against children who are in the home, or if the person has a if it's trafficking, you know, where there's not that strong personal relationship with, like, being a husband or something. And so they want to expand that to include children and also, I guess, violence against law enforcement, be it tribal police officers. So so that's up for reauthorization.
Any final thoughts? You have what are things you're working on right now, or are you in the Portland area yourself?
Oh yes, I. Portland, and like one of the things I did, I went back to school, and I've actually just one term of finishing my degree in sociology with them, and we're here, so, you know, keep your eye peeled for a benefit for the Miller family, and we're just going to keep fighting. We'll just keep moving forward. And people always say, hey, Deborah, what can we do? What can we do? I tell you, please tell people this, have the conversation, because I know that y'all care. I know it. I've seen it. Just the best thing you can do for us is tell another person, you know, just keep going with it. And we appreciate everything the community has done.
Well, I really appreciate the work you're doing, Deborah. I think having talked to you more about this just the level of support you provide to these families, it's, having interviewed and talked to a number of them, that's the most painful thing, is to have people not take your loved one's disappearance seriously, particularly law enforcement. Yeah. And then not knowing, having to reinvent the wheel. I mean, the Lone Bears basically have had to do this huge journey of not only conducting numerous searches across a vast area, but also to educate themselves about protocols that that law enforcement should be following to search for people, to help missing folks. And isn't that part of your idea too, is to form a task force to help these families so that they're not having to do this on their own?
That is. We need a task force. Actually, and I'm still working, trying to not be overly pushy about it, but here in our area is to have a task force operational before summer hits. Because one of the ways that these traffickers get to the girls and the young men is through fairs and carnivals and things like that. And if you just think about how many we have in the local area, I think it'd be an ideal time to get that idea up and operational.
All right. Well, it sounds like a good time to stop here. I want to thank you again, Deborah Maytubi Denton, founder of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA, on the line from here in Portland. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Anytime.
Thank you, Deborah.
Always willing to talk.
All right. And thank you, Jacqueline, for being here once again. We'll see you in a month, probably, huh?
Yes.
And once again, No Crime Scene, The Search for Olivia Lone Bear, her recent article on High Country News. And we didn't get to talk about the event that happened last night. Maybe another time.
Yeah, it was a good event. Yes.
All right. And when our website gets working fully again, I will have all this information on Wednesday Talk Radio.
You can also check my I have a Facebook page, Jacqueline Keeler Writer, and I can post it there until it's up on the KBOO website. So,
how lax of me to forget that you also have ways of getting in touch with you. Is that the best way?
Yeah, Facebook. I have a professional page, Jacqueline Keeler, and then I have other page, face a private one, but it's pretty full. So I can post all the information there. And if you want to see where I'm at next or learn about what I did last night, you can check my event page there. So,
okay, there you have it. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening. Thank you, Liam, for opping the board. This is Paul Rowland, Wednesday Talk Radio.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the NAIA Spring Marketplace on Saturday, May 12th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Native American Youth Association in Portland. Join Native small business vendors and artisans from around the Pacific Northwest as they display their goods, including beadwork, jewelry, pottery, woodwork, and more. Again, that's the NAIA Spring Marketplace on Saturday, May 12th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Native American Youth Association, 5135 Northeast Columbia Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy.